talk and for the exhibition. My name is Rachel Dempsey and I work as the Education Officer in the Latin America Solidarity Centre, which is a small NGO, Dublin-based. We work around campaigning, development, education and cultural work, basically looking to increase links and awareness between Latin American issues and Irish issues and the parallels between social change in Ireland and Latin America. And also my background is as an ethnomusicologist, so I'm just going to say a few words about the link between music and art in Latin America and social change. How many of you are interested in Latin America as a continent or as a region? Can you go? So kind of awareness, and you probably have fairly good awareness of Latin American issues. Yeah? And what about art and music? Who would be more interested in that side of things? And the mixture of both? Okay, brilliant. In Latin America, maybe firstly to talk about social movements and social change. You're probably aware that a lot of change in Latin America has been brought about not through typical political means, but by during the 60s, by guerrilla warfare, and nowadays there's a huge role for social movements, which can vary from small neighbourhood campaigns around, say, getting water in the area, to huge countrywide social movements for better housing. Like in Brazil, there's well-known big social movements that involve thousands of people. Most social movements use the art in some shape, way, or form. We have music, you have murals, which is a huge part of Latin American society, particularly in Mexico, Nicaragua, Central America. Everywhere you go around in those regions, you'll see murals and sort of educative artwork in the streets talking about family life. I was just in Mexico and Guatemala there, came back the other day, and there, say, small villages, you might have artwork saying living without violence in the family is a right, or you might have artwork just telling people to, you know, wash their hands after they use the loo, just this kind of thing. But the use of art and murals in education and social change is huge. Also, apart from community art, you have nationally recognized and internationally recognized artists that don't separate the aesthetic with the issues that people live on a daily basis. I think in Europe, for whatever reason, the two strands kind of separated over the last few hundred years, whereas in Latin America and possibly Africa and other continents as well, the whole realm of artistic expression is not removed from daily life, ritual, spirituality, family, every other aspect of life. So I think that's a key thing to keep in our minds, because we do separate the aesthetic with that which carries a message or that which is educative, whereas in Latin America it's not the case. Also, I think in terms of music, there's a greater emphasis on sound as a sensual and physical experience. So while, say, for example, in music, you have lots of examples where lyrics are specifically tackling issues of social justice, violence, repression, gender issues, and the lyrics will be plainly saying that. Whereas in other examples of music and social change, the lyrics are actually innocuous, they don't actually tackle any issues. But the fact that the sound is being created by the marginalized people in certain spaces, that in itself is something, is a protest. For example, Pep is going to talk about it now in a minute, but in Chile, in the 60s, when the powers that be and the elite of Latin America wanted everyone to emulate, you know, the states and Western music, and English was everything, and they just tried to ignore or repress native, as in Amerindian, expression. When musicians like Tito Jara and other musicians prominent at that time, when they started using Andean instruments, that alone was a protest. They didn't have to say anything in their lyrics, but the use of an Indian instrument would say, was making a statement in itself. similarly in Brazil in Carnival, 5 days where the marginalized people take to the streets and create a huge sound, like this, when you're there the sound literally hits you like a brick, you know, and it's just the idea of using sound to physically take over a space in terms of sound being a physical phenomenon. So I suppose you could make a parallel between Northern Ireland, the whole lambeg drums, the physical taking over of a space through sound is important in Latin America. So you have to think, well, I would always try to look at these phenomena in terms of the actual sensual experience as well as the political and the lyrics and that kind of thing that people are using. What other ways? Anyone else got any sort of other way of looking at music or art in Latin America to add in as a particular point? No? Okay, well, let's go over to, having had a bit of an overview of some of the issues and yeah, the use of the arts in Latin America in social protest and change, I'd like to introduce you to Pepe Gutierrez, who's also a member of the LAC committee, the Latin America Solidarity Center committee. And Pepe is Chilean and is going to talk about the whole Nueva Canción, or new song movement in Latin America, which was a huge protest song movement in the 60s, 70s in Latin America. Yeah. Over to Pepe.
Just to give a general overview of what you were saying, the music and art in general can be interpreted in many ways and can have more than one message. You know, one is explicit message you can give in lyrics. You know, there is also a non-explicit message that you can give through lyrics as well. Mm-hmm. When you express things that probably are not explicitly political, but have a certain impact over society as well. And probably the best local example I can think of. The punk explosion back in the 76, you know, there was no political message there. If you take the first wave of punk, there was no political message, no party belonging, but still the music was expressing a dissatisfaction of the youth at the time about the situation that surrounded them and all that. And then you have a third element that is how the music as an aesthetical experience can express as well discontent. As Rachel was talking about the instruments and all that. And just to give an example, it's not a coincidence that Pinochet, one of his first laws of when he, after the coup in 73, he started banning loads of things, you know, free press, number of things. One of the things he banned was a small string instrument of 12 chords that's called charango, because it was a tool for subversive ideas. And it was just an instrument, you know? Tiny. It's made with an animal called armadillo, the quirquinch. Armadillo probably in English, a double L. Yeah, armadillo. Yeah, you just take the heart, the core of the animal, and you use that as the base for this small guitar. Now, and that's a very good example of how a certain sound can be associated to a number of obnoxious things, you know, obnoxious for them actually. But in the Chilean case, in the Nueva Canción Chilena, it's probably one of the prime examples of music as a way to mobilize thousands of people, social change. The three elements came together, and that's probably one of the things that made it really particular. Actually, in the movement, some songs didn't necessarily have any party line. Some of them did have, you know. But all the subjects were about this part of society that constituted 80% of Chilean society that was completely denied from radio before that. You know, there was life in the countryside, there was life in the shanty towns, there was about things, you know, that were seen as decadent, you know, but they were our everyday life, you know, about being drunk, about being unemployed, you know. The songs were all about that. And the people behind the first explosion of Nueva Canción Chilena in the late 50s, all of them come from a very poor background, and they knew what they were talking about. You know, then they came some university lads, you know, and got into that, and more for political reasons than anything, you know. But and they have America as well, the bands like Ila Bayun and Tigimani come from that background, they're brilliant bands. And they have musical studies and all that, but the first wave, Victor Jara, none of them came from a scholar background. They came from the real thing, and they knew what they were talking about, and that's and that's the main point. And they happened to be militants of the Communist Party. That was a huge party at the time. Chile back in the 73 were 8 million people, 8.5 million people, and the Communist Party had 200,000 militants. So I was an important political force in society. And they tackled two things mainly. You know, one was to make the sound of the music in Chile more, the one you're listening to the radios, more American. You know, for that they took two sources. First was the obvious one, the Chilean source. You know, and they all started making popular, you know, on the radios and all that. Songs that have been there for centuries. You know, they've always been there, but they were always seen as drunkard's music, as music from illiterate, you know, but suddenly that music became to be mainstream, you know, with all this exposure, because it was a favorable environment for that to happen. You know, there was a lot of unrest, there was a lot of people wondering why we always had to be looking to Europe, you know, and that was part as well of a political, of the impact of a political movement over the common sense of the people when they said, no, we need to have a national development. We don't want to be providers of raw materials. The same happened with culture, you know. We don't want to be just reproducing things that come from outside. We want to start doing our own business here, you know. So that was on the one hand, but on the other hand, there was as well in making this sound more American. There was a spirit at the time that was very pan-American, you know. And the Che Guevara was the best example of that. A man that was born in Argentina that traveled to Chile, Peru, then Guatemala, then Cuba, did a wee revolution in Cuba, then went to Africa, and then went back to Bolivia where he died. That was a bit the best example, you know, when he said La Patria Grande, the big homeland. You know, that's the way we have for Latin America. And there was this idea of unity, so the use of the Chilean music started as well to be taken in a context that was a Latin American context, you know, and started taking inside a lot of influences, but not from the remote outside, but from the immediate outside, from the outside that is still part of us, you know, from Latin America. They started incorporating elements from Bolivian music, from Peruvian music, from Cuban music, from Panamanian music, Colombian music, and Venezuelan music. They all started being incorporated into a framework that was Chilean. And then that was added to lyrics that started being, that the traditional lyrics always express, you know, some sort of disconformity, you know, but then the disconformity started to be more and more explicit until they started reflecting, you know, a problem, literally, you know, the problem of the people that was developed in many ways during the 60s until the 70s and the maximum expression, despite the mistakes, despite everything, was popular unity from the 70s to the 73, the government of Allende that was started by the dictatorship Pinochet. That's a bit the origin of it. Then repression comes, and Pinochet, the first thing he does is to start banning the band, banning this little instrument as well, but mainly the band's message has been trying to put forward. And because music was seen as an integral part of this movement of change. And a very good example of that is when Victor Jara, the 11th of September, he got to be a teacher at University of Music without ever having any studies on music, you know, just because at the time it made sense, because he was a big man, he knew about music and all that, and he deserved it. Now we have the Chilean universities, I don't know, sort of distortion, that a professional distortion, that the title is more important than your actual knowledge, but I suppose it's the same all over the world. But anyway, yeah, at the time, you know, things were so wrong according to our ruling classes now, you know, that even a person could get to university, you know. And this man was there the 11th of September, that was the day of the coup. He was supposed to do classes there, and the lads come to him, you know, and say, listen, there is a coup, you know, Pinochet is in power now. What are you going to do? Are you going to take sword with us and fight and resist? And he said, oh, I'll let others resist in the way you mean, you know, grabs the guitar and say, this is all the weapon I need for now, you know, that's what I'll do. And it wasn't like he was cowardly not going to the barricades, because he stayed there, he sang to the very end, he was taken to a concentration camp, to a stadium, it was called a stadium Chile, He kept singing there for the prisoners, so they grabbed him, they hammered his hands, so he couldn't play the guitar anymore. He kept singing, and he was shot. So, and that way he became an icon as well of all this musical movement. So he was not someone that was shunning the responsibility of fight, you know, for your ideas. He was actually doing it in a different way, because it was seen, and it was what they had to do. It was their... It was their battalion. Mm-hmm. The musicians had their own battalion, and it was music, and it was joy, and it was bringing the message out. And well, that's a very good example. That's why the dictation preferred them so much, you know, because they were a powerful movement that was expressing all that. It was pretty much repressed, and musicians went into exile, musicians were murdered, they were tortured, and they were arrested. And then by the late 70s starts a new movement that took under dictatorship, still with the repression hard going on, but started taking the legacy of what was the Nueva Canción, and that was called the Canto Nuevo, that actually meant exactly the same but with different words, you know, the new song. And those bands had something in particular, that they were born in very repressive areas. The recordings of the time were all clandestine, very bad quality, really nice songs, but in a very poor quality of recording. And many of them as well were not musicians. They were just people that, if they were able to start to say, well, we have to start the people organized, you know, to show the discontent and all that, and they started playing. And it was like, well, I'm not a... It's like what happened in times of the resistance, you know, back in the 83, when the armed struggle started in the shantytowns against invitation. People say, well, I'm not a brave man, you know, but what can you do? You have to do it, you know? It's the same, well, probably I don't have much of a good voice, but I have to start singing, what can I do? You know, and that's what they had to do, and that's what they did brilliantly as well. There is a band from Julia that are awful musicians, but the songs have such a voice, you know? Every time you go to a concert out there, it's great crack, you know, people go mad, and it's brilliant. But they're awful musicians, you take it for one. They're improving now anyway. Take it for points, I think. And,
music for everyone.
I love them. Anyway, they started doing that, and there was something that was very funny, because at the time, the bands couldn't talk openly about the dictatorship, because obviously it was banned, so when there were concerts, you know, open concerts, they would sing about popular issues, but wouldn't touch directly the... But there were bands of kids, you know, little choirs and everything, and if they were 8, 7 years old, they could talk about the dictatorship. They were not going to be arrested. And there was actually a very good band that was called Genesis. There are some recordings of them around that were recorded, obviously always live, because they were never professional musicians, and they sung about people joining the resistance and made very tough lyrics for an 8-year-old kid, you know. It was the only way to put them to sing to tell the people. Actually, there is a video of the revolutionary left movement of Benin, and there is an image of them playing, but it's really sound, it's really good, and it's part of our history, you know.
Yeah.
It's part of our history, and that happened. But at the same time, in the 80s, there was this. At that time, it started to be expressed, the cultural activity, in different ways as well. You know, rock started taking a definite position there. There were bands that were completely irreverent at the time. They were like probably the equivalent to what was punk here.
Yeah.
But it wasn't punk, it was just rock. You know, there was a band that was called the Pinochet Boys. But by the very name, it was very funny. And they used to make like kind of these cheeky covers of Beach Boys and stuff like that, you know. They were all about the... It's all to do with the dictatorship, you know. But they expressed as well the how life was at the time.
Yeah.
You know, not only about the heroic aspect of struggle, you know, going out and all that, but they talk a lot about the kids meeting glue on the streets, you know, and about being stranded there after the 82, the economic crisis left everyone unemployed, 35-40% of unemployment in the country. And then other people just standing there on the street, they had this song of the Pinochet voice, in my spare time, that is 24 hours a day, I'm just standing on the corner, you know, chatting with my family, friends, having a drink, and I have no time to be in love. Sorry for that. You know, so, but it's a very, it used to be like that. And then you have the big ones, the Los Prisioneros, the prisoners. But they were really provocative because it felt like Sandinistas back in the days, you know, I'm talking about the 84 to the 88. And they started with very naive songs. They had one that was called Who Killed Marilyn? You know, well, obviously talking about Marilyn Monroe. But in one part they say, that's on the censor, because in one part they say, tell me if it was the president. You know, and when your president is actually killing people, you know, it's not a very, it's not just a simple rhyme, you know. And they...
Here's the way it sounds, you know, the way, the fact that they were repressed so much gave rise to so much more creativity, you know, musically and creative-wise.
Yeah, but at that time rock started really having an influence, you know, and probably the best example, and they were the last musicians to be exiled ever, the year 88. The year 88, that was the year when the referendum happened for Pinochet to be sent out of power. And, well, probably one of his last acts of repression was to send Los Prisioneros to Peru, because they were a bad influence to the youth. At the time it coincided when they started getting more and more political as well, from the first albums that are, they express a lot of disconformity, you know, to a second album that is slightly a bit more political, until the third album that is, it's openly political and has some songs, you know, about that are never say a name neither, you know, but it's quite obvious who is talking about. This song is called You and Your Ambition. So it's about, it's in general, you know, what Carl says, you have 1,000 workers that say hello to you and shake your hands, but they'd rather see you eaten by worms. That's one of the lines, you know, and it doesn't say who it's talking about, but it's quite obvious, you know.
Similar in the Brazilian movement, there was a similar movement in Brazil in the 70s. It was called Brazilian Popular Music, MPB, and they also, there was various quite prominent musicians who recorded songs, and they were systematically censored and banned by the powers of, you know, the dictatorship in Brazil at the time, but they became so subtle and so clever with their metaphors that sometimes they actually managed to have huge hits. Like Chico Huarque, he do you remember? yeah, that one. And there's one, Cálice. Cálice is like chalice, C-A-L-I-C-E. Well, it sounds like the word Cálice. Cálice means chalice in Portuguese. So as far as the authorities were concerned, it was a song about the chalice, you know, Christian Catholic imagery of the chalice and the red wine and so on, but actually it was Cálice, which means shut up. It's a homonym. Is it homonym? So it's the same word, yeah. And the red wine was a metaphor for blood, and the whole song was about telling the dictatorship to shut up and also being told to shut up, and the red wine as in the blood of the people. And I think that song managed to be released and was completely distributed everywhere before it was, they copped on and it was banned. But that happens quite a lot. And I think Chico Huarque,
it's funny because A Pesar de Buzet, it's one of the most famous samba songs ever, you know, in any compilation of Zamba, you know, Brazilian music, that song's going to be there. A few people know that it's a political song, actually. It means, despite of you, tomorrow's going to be another day. Just saying.
And it sounds like a love song, it sounds like a bitter kind of, you left me and now I'm heartbroken, but it's, you know, completely. It's similar to Irish poetry in the, you know, the whole Gaelic revival time. But, you know,
Irish in Argentina carry forward in this.
Did the Irish in Argentina get involved in this?
I don't know. They did very well.
Yeah.
No, the Irish mainly in all of America, or as you call it here, the Americas. No, our continent that is one, it's plural here. I don't know why, but anyway, in the Americas, the role of the Irish is mainly very conservative.
Yeah.
In most places, the only good thing the Irish did over there, from a leftist point of view, was in Mexico when they joined with the San Patrick Battalion, when they joined the Mexicans. They were taken by the USA Army to fight the Mexicans in the 1870s for the war with Mexico.
Yes.
And they changed sides and fought with the Mexicans against the Yanks. And that was called the San Patrick's Battalion, actually.
But
anyway, San Patrick.
But what I timidly cut in, but it was used poetry and language very much in Ireland, right back to Ribby Nodish or The Boys of Wexford or Brendan Behan. But it's only an instrument. The question what you're trying to build. And a great deal of it can be a disharmony. But what surely you need is a system that will build things up, not blow up. Build up rather than blow up. It seems to me that the Latin American poetry and the men behind the wire and other things are concentrating much more on blowing up than on building up. That they're not trying to develop land reform or cooperatives or some cooperative industrial system or something like this. I don't think this is getting anywhere.
You mean the revolutionaries and the left?
I think the revolution is blowing up rather than building up.
No, I think that's it. Probably you're misinformed. Absolutely, because I mean there is a huge rank and file movement from time.
Well, that's what I would want.
Well,
here I associate this sort of time rather with petrol laundering than cooperatives.
But it's probably part of the folkloric image and the exoticism of the view of the world from Europe.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think Europeans, it's very funny. If they think of Africans, you know, they're going to think of famine. If they think of Latin America, they're going to think of a man with moustache and a machine gun. If you think of Asia, you're going to think probably, I don't know, someone carrying you in one of these carts.
Yeah.
So it's a very folkloric image, but the reality, the truth of the matter is that we have probably one of the most constructive movements ever, and it has from quite early on a vocation of regenerating society. Most of the Regeneración was one of the most famous revolutionary papers that has an idea, and the cooperatives, the factory takeovers, land occupations, land reform have been on the motto of Latin American movements early in the 19th century.
One place that Ireland did have a big influence in this kind of way is one which is not particularly popular in a very good reason. The whole agricultural system in Israel is copied from Ireland. The kibbutzim were directly copied from the one in the co-op in Raheim, where Shannon Airport is now, which worked extremely well, and they copied it exactly from books about that. Similarly, the various Mushavim and so on were copied from the writings of Horace Plunkett and others. That's what I would like to see. Now, not that those people weren't going to use it. But we have good things to offer. I'm afraid that the image that goes out of Ireland musical is rather, to my mind, cacophonous. It's not. I mean, the way that the Finns use their poetry and that is hugely positive. Something that they're really proud of, that the taxi driver will come along and tell you how wonderful it is. But don't kick up around here because the Sibelius or somebody is composing. But that was something positive they were really proud of and led them on to do excellent things, even in spite of the Russian movie.
I mean, just to look at that, what you say with the Latin music,
sure.
I think that there is a link to workers' movement, which is very strong in Latin American music, and also very strongly linked into the workers' movement and workers' song, which I was talking about in the union song in North America. And Kelly or Tracy Moore, like that, are linking in very much in those traditions with both the songs of Pete Seeger in America.
But still, in the case of Latin America, we have very heavy
union,
and we have very, but we have as well very heavy chains and very strong chains of domination. and you have to blow them up at some point. And you can't think of one without the other. You know, we are constructing, we are building our movement, but at the same time we just have to shake off a yoke that has been keeping us down for ages. And the best example as well is back again Chile, you know. We were doing reasonably well, you know. We had the copper nationalized, we had a factory takeover, so the workers set up their own cooperatives, the industrial networks. I mean, there was a brilliant movement of rank and file activity. Back in the 72, the bosses all have a lockout, and they say, we're not going to distribute any products. The people go out, they expropriate the bosses, and they set up the what we would call the HAP, the Councils of Distribution and Production. So they check out that if the boss are not going to be selling, we take them from there and we sell it ourselves at popular prices. And they sorted out every problem that was posed by, to put it in one word, by imperialism, you know. But at the end of the day, imperialism, you know, was able to put its job back by military intervention, you know. And that's why, unfortunately, no matter how much we built, it was so smashed, you know, because the roots of the exploitation, of the oppression, remain the same.
Yeah.
And our people need to blow them up. And that's still a task for us. No one is going to do it for us, you know.
And that's true.
Our freedom will be gained
you
by the force of our own
people. The Irish cooperatives were very much sent by the English workers' cooperatives. Are you getting your workers' cooperatives and so on from Europe in their trade, very big trade, some of the largest people, in wine, for example, and many other things. Are you linking in with the positive unions and cooperatives? Like the biggest banks in France and elsewhere are cooperative. Pretty every door.
But not only that, I mean, the movement is far more than cooperatives over there.
Well, I'm going to take that as an example.
In terms of the workers'
cooperatives,
I think we probably could, because it's efficiently
on the ground. But we have to go for music,
But I think we probably should stay with music for now, and then we're all going to be standing around for another 2 hours.
Music is an instrument towards that.
And if you take, for instance, again, Victor Jara, you have two songs, one is Legaria La Lado, and here, that is an ode to resistance, you know, to growing up, if you want to put it in your man's words, you know. But at the same time, you have another song that is Que lindo ser voluntario, something like, so good to be a volunteer, that is about the people getting involved, calling the people to get involved as well in these programs of workers' organizations. And you have the two of them. I mean, the invitation to change the world, an invitation as well to take part in that task.
They were all always holistic in their approach. That they, from an outside of looking into, say, that particular Nueva Canción movement, what strikes me was that it, although some of the key figures had links with political parties like the MIR or whoever, Popular Unity, that wasn't the main thrust of the energy. The thrust was, you know, the fact that they used to play in the neighborhoods in the evenings, you know, in a kind of, what do you call it, the little, you know, the, where they all got together, like a peña, like it was a whole way of meeting and discussing issues that affected everybody through music, and the issues of gender, of like even the, not so much gender in the typical let's give women equal rights, but those songs and that movement even approached the issue of romantic love and shattering the illusion of, you know, romantic love and talking about love in a more holistic, real kind of a way, earthy way, and it was, you know, every aspect of life was actually dealt with in the songs and in the movement itself, and how the music brought people together in a particular way, not as performers and audience, but you know, everybody fed off one another, and it was a forum for
talking. But at the same time, historical process marked the pace of music as well, and the music was reflecting in the lyrics and even in the attitude, you know, different stages of the political process. Until the 73, until the coup of Pinochet, you have a lot of, you know, messages of come and join and let's rebuild society, Ares Alambrar, let's take the wires off, it's a call to land reform, you know, La tierra tuya mía, que María de Juan, y que se... It's a call to land reform. And there are lots of songs that are calling for that, you know, are calling for taking part in the hubs, taking part in against the boycott of the ruling class of the country. Then you have the time of the resistance. And at the time, you know, there was no agrarian reform in sight, there was no independent organization in sight, but it was all about rebuilding the resistance movement, you know, against the dictatorship. And the music was reflecting that as well, you know, was reflecting its time, you know, and you can agree or disagree with the approach, but the music was reflecting something that was going on, you know. And then in the 90s, when the dictatorship falls over but leaves a very fake democracy, you know, it's completely hollow, with not even the scent of any form of liberties as we know and here in Europe with a two-party system, that is a complete sham, you know. Big sectors of society remain marginalized, big sectors of society that were marginalized by the neoliberal turn of Chilean economies around the late 70s, you know, when the industry starts shutting down, a lot of people go unemployed and there are these big lumps of unemployment in the capital, and there is an emerging popular movement that is not political at all, it's the cumbia, you know, and that's the big musical scene of the 90s, you know, and it's reflecting as well marginality, and of course don't think of probably of very positive things, you know, they think about the introduction of crack into the neighborhood, they think about being drunk and unemployed all the time, being lovelorn, you know, because if you have no work, if you're an alcoholic, it's obvious that you're not going to have a woman to sing to, so you're lovelorn all the time, you're always with your heart broken. But all comes together, and the music is reflecting that as well, uncomfortable reality for the Chilean ruling class to go around the world saying that Chilean paradise, you know, the economic miracle, the model and all that. But then you go to Chile, and if you know Spanish, you will listen to these songs while you're going in the bus, while you're waiting for and drinking a coffee. And the lyrics are really uncomfortable, you know, because it's a very nasty aspect of that economic miracle. And it's reflecting as well its time. And it has a very strong, subversive importance at the time. And yeah, from that, the cumbia singers are moving as well. And then you have, for instance, like Chisos, a band now singing this song La Temporera. It's about this woman that goes to work in the countryside, you know, picking up fruits, you know, because she's been told that she's going to make enough money, you know, to save and then go back. But the years pass, you know, she never gets to see his son grow, and she still can't go back because she has no money at all. And that, well, it's the same as the immigration sometimes here in Europe. And that's a reality internally in our country, you know, and that happens. So no wonder why the Chilean, let's say, from upper middle class on, you know, think that the cumbia is such a bad taste music. Because the thing about things, subjects they don't want to hear, you know. And that is subversive in its own right. You know?
Similar to salsa in the 1970s. Yeah. When salsa actually started in New York with the Latin American migrants from Puerto Rico, Cuba, Dominican Republic, and when they went to New York, they experienced their identity in another way, not as Puerto Ricans, but as Latinos. And the Cubans, Puerto Ricans, all of the Latinos were lumped into the one dodgy area of whatever town they were in, and began to see themselves as Latin Americans and began to write salsa. Well, originally they were playing their own rural music like son, plena, all of the rural tunes from, or styles from their countries. They would be transferring that over to the States and playing it in the way that they would have. But then they realized that didn't talk to their own community because things had changed, they were in a different environment. So that's why salsa actually emerged, you know, blending with the jazz and the brass and the harsh, kind of harsher sounds that reflected the urban, chaotic life that they were living. So, you know, you had the traditional rhythms of Cuba and so on, mixed with the jazzy, brash, harsh stuff from New York and other cities, and that blended to give salsa in the 70s. And originally, salsa lyrics were all about, you know, going around with your knife and getting, you know, mugging people for money and
Pedro Navaja.
And what else?
Peter Blade.
Yeah.
No, that's one of the most famous ones.
And Rubén Blades, Plástico. About, you know, this classic song with about 100 verses, first about the plastic guy who carries his comb in his back pocket and who always talks about cars, and the plastic girl who wants to marry a doctor, and that they all really are up to their eyes in debt trying to maintain all their appearance, you know, this appearance of being middle class US kind of family. And you can see that to this day, like
that's
Hispanic families.
Dinner on the Moor is typical anarchic. It's perfectly bad, it was good at the time. You don't want it now.
The point you made earlier on though about the starting point about the art being not disconnected from the general life,
yeah,
and the music, like when you're talking about the songs and what the content, what they're talking about, and that is a tool for change, it's very much part of the actual current culture. And it has been something that's all been all the way through history. And I'm just going to throw it two other points into this music equation. The time of Galileo, when like after Copernicus said that the Earth isn't the centre of the universe and it's like just going around the sun, then Galileo was able to prove that I suppose this to make the point just that music and the surrounding culture is another communication tool. When Galileo wrote his papers, he didn't write it in Latin, he wrote it in the local dialects of the people, and it was put out to the people because the power structure, the church, was saying, no, you can't be saying this,
The people in Italy couldn't read. So what you're saying is that he was writing in Italian, but actually the people really couldn't read, and they started to read in the 1970s or something. So really, when Galileo was explaining his sorry for interrupting, but really fine Italian is something.
Oh no, this is just what I heard.
Oh, weird.
But then is it not true then that
the real revolution of writing in Italian was Dante, but it was
But the point I was getting to was
but
that.
Perhaps the
person who could get it, who wasn't in the power structure, was one of the people, whatever way. But that the actual form of bringing about change, like we accept Galileo's opinions now, but from what I've heard, it was that the people took to the streets through carnival on the streets, and they were bringing the ideas which went against the held church state view, saying that the earth is the centre because it makes sense because of Genesis and all that. And they started mocking the state system, saying that no. So they, through the system of carnival, music, rhymes, all that which the people were doing, that was part of the process which educated people, that the ideas that the earth is actually going around sun, that was just one thing. Right around, it can be open to debate. It's what I've heard, I don't know. And the other example then is going on to more modern culture of music, not so much the what's being said in the music, but more the music of the sound and the world that brings about, was the sort of the techno scene in the 80s. If you look at like Berlin as probably a good example, before the wall came down, and then the people, rather than people being on the streets protesting, going, you know, boo, this is wrong, it's all boring stuff, you know, marching up and down the street, people says, right, let's, rather than being anti, let's be for something. Right, let's do something about it. Let's make something amazing. Let's make it something that excites people. So 150 people taking the streets for tolerance, understanding and respect between nations. That gave rise to the Berlin Love Parade. 10 years later, 1.5 million people dancing in the streets. Granted, there was a little bit of commercial stuff. Techno became big, race, you know, that sort of stuff. But it started by a positive, a wish, a dream of something better, and a taking positive, creative action to work toward that. And that sparked something magical. Mm-hmm. And suddenly people latched on. Wall came down, etc. Communist bloc, Eastern bloc. So they're just two examples. Maybe right or wrong, I don't know, but just coming for this discussion.
Use music, but the magic was black.
Yeah, I mean, music can be used in any way.
And I think this applies to some of the left-wing music also, that what they're going for isn't long-term politics.
I'm being a chain himself. He has his own musician, you know, that are real embarrassing, really bad as well. Digging Ballet, Ballet, awful. And they were just doing this because they were awful, not because they were a parody of themselves. You know, they were just singing about happiness, you know, about things being great. They had this song that was, "Estamos bien mañana mejor," we are so good now, tomorrow we're going to be better.
And you have 40% unemployment, you have, you know, big problems, big troubles, you know, a big level of kids' malnourishment, you know. And yeah, they were a parody of themselves because they were not reflecting the spirit of the time. And he has his own musicians, and definitely they probably have an effect as well, you know. So music can be used
by anyone in any way.
But as a tool for social change, it really has proved good. And the important thing is how to make marginal styles and all that something that is mainstream. You know, the cumbia is still marginal, but will become just like the new Chilean song was by the end of the 50s. You know.
Yeah, but sometimes it can change, you know, as it gets more and more popular and commercialized, the edge is taken off and then something else starts, you know.
But it depends as well of how much it's linked to something real.
Yes.
You know, if the music is not linked to something real, it can be commercialized. The new Chilean song was never commercialized because it was always linked to a very, very real movement that was out there and was really reflecting.
Does anyone have anything to add before we...
Yeah, do you feel that sometimes that's because of the commercial and where you take the music? I mean, in a way, commercialism is set to the capitalism, that's the tool that's just such a stuff that you can actually take anything and use that as a form of control. So it's something that you start with as a protest, which becomes manipulated and then actually becomes part of the...
It could, in principle, I have no problem with bands selling. I think that if a band is a rebel band and it sells all the best, first of all, I'm not into the thing that we have to keep bands small, you know, and underground and all that. I'm not into that personally myself. And probably most of the bands I like are not that at all, you know, but again, I go back to the same point. It depends on how much it is linked to a real movement. You know, I mean, yes, salsa has been manipulated on commercial and all that, you know, and then you have anti-Cuban bands, you know, and all that, because the salsa itself was expressing a lot of things, so it was not connected to any real movement, you know, and I think that's the point when you take it from expressing some marginal culture into being the voice of something else.
I think it certainly it's really hard to actually pinpoint whether it's still subaltern or whether it's a tool of oppression, because I think, say with salsa, a lot of people like ethnomusicologists, sociologists have now said no, salsa is no longer subaltern in any way, it doesn't represent any movements for change, la la la. But there have been studies that have shown that the way salsa is consumed in the States is still an expression of a Latin identity, of resistance towards the homogenization of society, you know, that when Latin American, not all obviously, but you know, when certain ways and certain people consume salsa, i.e. go to salsa clubs or buy salsa, with a kind of sense of resistance, a sense of this is who I am, this is Latin America, this is not the States, this is not my, you know, buying into any big commercial thing, you know, quite the opposite. But then that depends who, where they are and who they are with and how they dance. And the same with, say, Carnival, we'll finish up now. Carnival in Brazil, some people argue that it's specifically those 5 days and the fact that, you know, the people in the favelas are working, we're working big time and spending huge amounts of money and time, 8-9 months of the year for these 5 days of Carnival, spending huge amounts of money and so on. But that's actually the government's way of it has like a safety valve. There won't be a revolution because people are too busy getting their costumes ready for Carnival. Other people will argue, no, that those 5 days, the world turns upside down and the marginalized are symbolically taking over, and that's a positive thing for social change. So it's really hard to pinpoint it. But maybe any last comments before we wind up?
We might need to finish up in a moment.
Yeah.
Anybody, yeah? One of the most influential songs in Irish history is Mary Had a Little Lamb. The children used to sing Mary Had a Little Lamb, She Cried the Snow, shouting out the battle cry of freedom, and singing that around the police and the military. Lampooning is a wonderfully effective system. it seems to have disappeared from Irish music nowadays. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, by the way, Nef Four Rice is also
Christy.
Mm-hmm.
Christy?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for coming along and Rachel very much for the talk. It's really, really interesting, inspiring talk. Sure they'll both be around for a while if you maybe want to go and ask them. Some of the music that's being talked about, you can listen to it over here at the presentation. Oh, and well, do you want to say a little bit about that? There's a something that you should all sign on your way out the door. It's a petition for the
Canquamo Indians in Colombia are in a very complicated area that it's been disputed now because of some ecotourism projects that have been pushed out of the land. In the process of the last 2 years, 170 of them have been murdered, but it's an enormous amount for just a population of 10,000 people. And some of those projects received funding from the European Union in terms of development aid. It's development aid that has been sent to the Colombian government, and it's been used to push people out of their land at a great life cost. We're going to send that petition to the Department of Foreign Affairs, and we would love it, as many people as possible to help with the signature.
A last thing as well, if you enjoyed the exhibition and you should look around the rest of that place, if you want to know more about Colo, there's also information about LASC, they have a lot more to tell about it. Please sign your name and we'll let you know about other exhibitions. And thank you again.
If people, there's an email list there. If people want to leave their email, we can send out a link. But as well, if people log on to the website, indymedia.ie, indymedia.ie, the Irish part of the Global Indymedia Network. This is recorded, it'll be up there, so you can click and listen to it. But as well, it's open, so you can add on your links, whatever to keep the discussion going. And if there's future meetings, discussion, music listenings, whatever, that's hopefully a place where we can keep the contact. And if you want to know more about the Indymedia Network and Argentina struggle, it's on the film over there, Ida Stone.
Confusion aside.